We'll ask Brother Stephen now then, please, to step forward and deliver those words intended to help us on our walk Zionwards. Brother Stephen, please.
My beloved brethren and sisters in the glorious hope of Israel, this morning's exhortation is actually based upon an exhortation that Brother Grocott gave on Isaiah's prophecy, chapter 52. We have all doubtless been impressed through our daily readings of the coincidence of how sometimes the daily readings link up. I mean, when the first portion, for example, paints a similar picture to the middle or last reading of the day. And brethren and sisters, we had such a situation just over a week ago when we read Isaiah 52. Come with me to Isaiah 52 and verse 1, which links up with the readings for that day of Revelation chapter 14. Isaiah 52. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall no more come into thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Now let us compare that to Revelation chapter 14, the book of the Apocalypse, chapter 14 and verse 8. Chapter 14 and verse 8, we read, "And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." In Isaiah, we have the restored nation of Israel, the rebuilt Jerusalem, into which the world will never be allowed to enter in again, when the King of Kings and Lord of Lords shall reign from the metropolis of the whole earth. In the Apocalypse, we have the parallel record of the harlot Babylon falling into the depths of the earth, having been crushed and swept with the besom of destruction, who shall be ground to powder when the stone image is overthrown by Christ and his multitude of saints. Brother Grocott says, "The holy city, the city of life and hope and light, and the unholy city, the city of death and confusion and evil, the city of future eternal joy, and the city of the present passing pleasure." Both of these chapters carry us forward to the time when the wisdom of the true choice will be manifested for the blindest to see. Zion truly exalted and Babylon destroyed. No exhortation or persuasion will be needed then to point out the advantages of the more excellent way. It will be convincingly clear to all, but the books will have been closed, and the decree will have gone forth. The words of Christ, "He that is unjust, let him be unjust still." Too late then to seek oil in panic-stricken confusion. There was plenty of time once and constant pleadings, but now it is too late. As a child grows up under the leadership of his parents, there will be times when the child is disobedient and foolish. And the parents plead with the child to do that which is right and that which is wise. So we have a father, far above our earthly parents, and we have an elder brother who is the all-wise, who has pleaded with us in the scriptures of truth to remain steadfast on the straight and narrow path. I remember at the start of the Ashfield debates, one speaking brother saying, "How many people would like the words of Christ reversed? How many would like the words 'straight is the gate and narrow the way' to read 'broad is the gate and wide the way'? And many there be which go in thereat." Yes, brethren and sisters, our Heavenly Father pleads with us to contribute to the development of the holy city and forsake the things that are without, the basis of which excites the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Those things belong to the unclean and the uncircumcised, which shall not enter Zion when the people of the city shall be arrayed in beautiful garments. Now this picture of the two cities, two rival commonwealths is woven all through the scriptures, is it not? This pictorial and allegorical form of teaching greatly helps the memory and impresses these lessons upon our imaginations. The seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman run parallel right from the beginning. From the time Cain hated and slew Abel because he was annoyed and condemned by Abel's more faithful and fuller life, the two cities have existed. Cain went, we are told, and built himself a city. He built himself a city, an establishment, a centre, an organisation, a foundation of power. Abel already had a city. He was satisfied and secure. So Cain hated him in the misery of his own misdirected and unsatisfied desires. The sons of God, in the many years that followed, grew tired of the journey Zionward. The vision of the future for them grew dim. The glittering and pleasureful cities of the children of men became too much for them, and soon they were found leaving the sure foundation of Abel and Seth to join in union with the sons of men. God's punishment for so doing was catastrophic, as we know, only 8 people being saved, and not all of those heeded the pleading of Yahweh. Genesis 11, verse 4. The generation after the flood, we read, and they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. They had once again a desire to build a man-made city based upon the thoughts and desires of the flesh. Follow their history, brethren and sisters. Give us a city. Give us a king. Give us something we can see and handle, something social and something exciting. The spiritual city, this divine king, this joy of the spirit and treasure in heaven are rather thin fare for the natural appetite. Our soul loatheth this light bread, which was divinely provided from heaven. Which city, brethren and sisters, are we a true part of? Had we been living among those in the days of Noah, would we have made up the 9th person entering into the ark, or would we have been with a multitude? Would we have been a Joshua and Caleb, or would we have been with the multitude of moaners complaining about the manna in the wilderness? Among these generations, there was one outstanding example, the faithful man Abraham, who sought, rather than a man-made city, a heavenly city, a city which hath foundations. Hebrews 11 and verse 10. Verse 8 for connection. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham had an obsession, a real desire for something true, real, and lasting. In Psalm 127, verse 1, David had a similar obsession, and he truly recognized that unless the city was for Yahweh, the foundation was temporary. Psalm 127, verse 1. Psalm 127, verse 1. Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except Yahweh keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. He sought for a city whose builder and maker was God. Abraham had a vision, and he never allowed that vision to become dim. He beheld the King of Righteousness sitting in the gate of Jerusalem as he was set upon a mountain in the land of promise. He was satisfied to leave the city of Ur, to leave the kingdom of men, to sacrifice the things of the world and to embrace the simple promise of God and dwell in this world as a stranger and sojourner, realizing that we have no continuing city with the exception of the city of the great King. He was willing to be separate from the city of the children of men and wait in faith for that better country whose foundations were from heaven. We know also that Lot, not too far from the mountain where Abraham was at, was commanded by God to flee to the mountains and escape the judgments to be poured out in God's vengeance against the people of his city. Genesis 15, verse 17. Chapter 15, verse 17. It might be Chapter 19, I'm sorry, brothers and sisters, verse. Verse 15. And when the morning arose, then the angel hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, Yahweh being merciful unto him. And they brought him forth, and set him without the city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of this city. We see then, do we not, the great catalogue of cities being added to the list. In this particular case, the city of corruption being added to the list of the city of confusion of Babel. These are important historical times for us to consider and contemplate. We see so many times history repeating itself, and we see many more cities in the scriptures being added to the list. Come with me to Isaiah 52 and verse 4. For thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, chapter 52, verse 4, My people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrians oppressed them without cause. Brother Grocott on this says, See how marvelously the hand of God worked in this. And as we read, let us be impressed, he says, with the inexorable workings of God's justice. Slow, invisible, often disguised, but terribly sure and strikingly fitting. He says, Rebekah misled Jacob, very well-meaning, but still deception. Jacob deceived Isaac, very well-meaning, but still deception. Laban deceived Jacob, not quite so well-meaning. Jacob's sons deceived Jacob and sold Joseph into slavery into Egypt, ill-meaning and vicious. And finally, the Egyptians betrayed and enslaved the Israelites and killed their children as they had thought to do so to Joseph. What a gradually broadening chain of evil and sorrow. And what did the Israelites have to do in Egypt? Exodus 1 verse 11, they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses. What irony, says Brother Grocott, the sons of God sunk to ignorant slavery and forced to build cities for earthly treasures of the children of men. The next typical unholy city was Jericho. This was an important place, a strong fortress, and indeed the gateway to the conquest of the land of promise. It was the first city confronting the Israelites as they set out to occupy their inheritance. Its defeat was miraculous and symbolic, and its utter destruction was complete. Now Jericho is several times called the city of palm trees, as we know. We know that palm trees represent, or palms represent, triumph and joy, victory after faithful struggle. Leviticus 22 verse 40, palms appear here in the Feast of Tabernacles. John 12 verse 13, Christ's royal entry into Jerusalem where the people were carrying palms in their hands. Revelation 7 verse 9, people in the hands of the victorious host before the throne, again with palms. And then Psalms 92 verse 12 and the Song of Solomon 7 verse 7, the righteous here are likened to the straight, erect beauty of the palm tree. How then can Jericho be aligned with the city of palms? Because, brethren and sisters, it was a counterfeit copy of the true. Jericho is symbolical of the cities of men and the false ecclesiastical city. Jeremiah hints at this in Jeremiah 10 verse 5, where he says, they are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They have a form of godliness, which in the scriptures is described as dead, because their godliness lacks the living power. You know what we mean by this. You see it quite often in salespeople or in their presentations. They tell you that their product is the best, give you all the reasons for that. But sometimes they lack the commitment, the enthusiasm. They lack a belief in the product, which makes their sales pitch dead. The buyer can see right through them, as it were. But when the word of God is implanted deep into our hearts and powerfully operates upon our sentiments, then we become a part of the godliness required and not a part of the form of godliness, which really is hypocrisy. These lacked the power and had the dead form of godliness. They lacked that living power. Trees without fruit, Jude says. Twice dead. Come with me to Jude, verse 10. Jude, verse 10. Jude verse 10, that these speak evil of those things which they know not, but what they know naturally as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves. Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward, and perished in the gainsaying of Kor. These are spots in your feasts of charity, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withereth without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. In this light, the city of Rome, or the Roman city, is preeminently a city of palm trees, for their dead idols are legion. As the destruction of Sion and Og typify the defeat of Gog, so the subduing of Canaan with its seven nations typifies the subduing of the earth. Seven, as we know, is the number of completeness. At the sounding of the seventh trumpet, on the seventh day, Jericho fell, and so will Great Babylon, the unholy city, fall. Jericho had to be utterly destroyed. The other cities of the land they took over and used, but not Jericho. As the fourth beast of Daniel 7, verse 11, a curse of perpetual destruction was upon it. It was never to be rebuilt. But someone in their midst failed to realize the great power and omnipresence of the Creator who led them and who was among them. Great trouble came upon the whole camp until the wicked coveter was put out of their midst. We know that God had promised things in abundance when the time was right, but now was a time when they could not have. Achan was out of harmony with the purpose of God. He could not wait. 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5. Verse 26. Yahweh says concerning the men of the cities, and he said unto him, went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed for ever. And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. Yahweh says concerning the men then of these cities of the plain who enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season. He says, behold, they have their reward. Do we have our reward already? Are our garments the garments of the flesh, so to speak, with all the jewels, with all the glitter, the colours that go with them? Or are our garments the beautiful garments spoken of by Isaiah? Come with me to Joshua 7, verse 21. A very, very important passage of Scripture for our consideration this morning. Joshua chapter 7, verse 21. When I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonish garment, and 200 shekels of silver, and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, then I coveted them, and took them. And behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. I saw, I coveted, I took, and I hid. He thought he hid. What a pitiful situation, brethren and sisters, and what a delusion he was in. He dug a hole and hid it away from God. Is it possible that sometimes we are as foolish as that? And what was it? It was a goodly Babylonian garment. What a snare those goodly Babylonish garments have been to the children of God throughout all the ages. It was a goodly one, doubtless one of Babylon's best, and the very latest model, no doubt. But was it worth the price he paid for it? John saw the unholy city in a Babylonian garment. Revelation 17, verse 4. Revelation 17, verse 4. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. These are the precious metals and ornaments, the pearls, etc., that are counterfeit, as are the palm trees. The outward adorning that deceives the world into believing a lie at the hands of the Mother Church, and indeed some of the faith, are possibly so deceived. The elect should have little fear of falling prey to the doctrines of the Mother of Harlots, but their doctrines aren't quite as subtle as their practices. Her customs, institutions, and thinking permeate the world. People don't realize it, but the world of today is still very much a Roman world, despite the fact that Roman Empire has been diffused. Those around the world on December the 25th who put up tinsel, Christmas trees, lights, and partake in all of the other practices of Christmas are paying more or less conscious homage to the Scarlet Woman on the Seven Hills. Apocalypse chapter 18 verse 23 reads, "By her sorceries were all nations deceived. By her sorceries were all nations deceived." But Isaiah the prophet, in this 52nd chapter, tells us of better garments, does he not, than the Babylonish garments. Isaiah 52. "Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion. Put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy or separate city." Here then, brethren and sisters, we see the picture of the future and how refreshing it is to our souls to behold. What a change of scene. Here is the beauty of holiness which so delighted the heart of the psalmist. What is holiness? We know it is the separation from the corrupt city and all that belongs to it. It is the separateness without which none shall see the Lord, Hebrews 12, verse 14. It is nothing strange or mysterious. Worship the Lord in the beauty of separateness. Separateness from anything that is displeasing to God or out of harmony with his ways. We can see the fruit or the results of this separateness. And it is necessarily perfect beauty. Let us exhort one another daily to remain separate, to remain in harmony with the ways of God and in keeping with the precepts which give him pleasure now and more fully in the glorious age to come, when the weakness of the flesh will no more so easily beset us. Let us always bear in mind the words of Hebrews 12, verse 14. Separateness without which none shall see the Lord. When we visit the state shortly, brethren and sisters, let us not be fearful to discuss these issues of holiness with our brethren and sisters there. As I said in my address in North Carolina, the lack of separateness is a big problem in the brotherhood, and it should not be underestimated. Let us ensure that we are not fence-sitters, the friends of all for the sake of peace. Brother Grocott, in a separate exhortation in Be Transformed, says, "There is a time and place for soft and gentle words, but when it comes to the defense of truth, in keeping it pure and alive in these last days of Gentile times, let us take the words of encouragement and speak plainly in upholding the truth without compromise. Then, after the briefest of greetings and a basic statement of his proposition that deliverance comes from and through Christ alone, and specifically through Christ's death for sin, according to the will of God, he plunges right into his sharp rebuke," verse 6. And this is in connection with the book of Galatians, the epistle of Galatians. "I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you," that is God, "into the grace of Christ and to another gospel." The Galatians had turned from God, from the grace of Christ and from the gospel of salvation. They would not, of course, recognize or admit this, but Paul leaves no middle ground. He cuts the issue sharp and clear from the very beginning. It's this or that. They are opposite extremes. They can't be both. This is what we must do in our presentation of the truth. There are those who want to emphasize all points of agreement first, says Brother Grocott, and then work up to the differences. This is confusion. The scriptural way is to point out the great, broad dividing line between truth and error, the major, basic differences that one must choose between at the outset, and then fill in the details. Then come those thundering words twice repeated, which are so often and rightly quoted to introduce our lectures. If we or any, or an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel, let him be accursed. What vehemence! Where is the gentle, diplomatic, conciliatory, brotherly Paul? He shows up later in the epistle, in the proper place, after he has lifted up the fallen banner of truth among them, high and bright and uncompromising. But this was the time for very, very plain speaking. Beauty is to be held, isn't it? We all know what beauty is in the abstract, but it's not in the abstract that we need to behold it. We must behold it from God's point of view. Come with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Verse 11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before him. The Proverbs say, charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. Also, beauty without spiritual understanding is like a jewel in a swine's snout. Beauty is purely a matter of spiritual education and discernment. It is inward and not outward. Come with me to 1 Peter chapter 3. First Peter chapter 3, verse 3. Whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Brother Grocott says that one of the only representations of outward show that is acceptable to Yahweh is the wearing of an external head covering. The wearing of a head covering on the part of sisters is an outward show of their submission to the brethren, and especially to their own husbands, in which God delights. We see then the appointment which God created for his own pleasure. Long hair, says Paul, is a glory to the woman, and God would have it so. The head covering is a token to the glory of our Creator. When we look at some of the general principles involved and some of the general symbols behind these lessons, we can see why that our brethren who teach their wives to wear a head covering for all prayer and not just at ecclesial meetings. Brother Grocott says, there is one item of outward glory and beauty that God has expressed delight in, one that he himself has expressly created for glory. While of great beauty and dignity in itself, its chief beauty in God's eyes lies in the evidence of wisdom and discernment and humble acceptance of and obedience to God's will. Its importance rests in its symbolism of harmonious God-appointed relationship. In God's love and wisdom, he has made this a token of blessing and honor, and the marring of it a matter of sorrow and shame. Yes, brethren and sisters, the world's fashions change from day to day. Tattoos on women, as an example, would have been for a certain class of woman 50 years ago. But today most have them, in all their ugliness and unpleasantness. Yahweh, however, never changes. He has a desire toward us, and that is that we wear the beautiful garments, not of the outward fleshly appearance, but of the meek and humble, yet spiritual in faith, which is shown outwardly by what we speak, how we walk, and how we express our thoughts. The question is, and this is a serious question requiring the deepest contemplation and reflection, do we have on the garments of the world, or do we have the garments of righteousness, of separateness, separate beauty, which things give glory to Yahweh, and in which he delights? Come back with me to Isaiah 52, verse 7. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, Thy Elohim reigneth. Thy watchmen shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye, when Yahweh shall bring again Zion. Break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem, for Yahweh hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Jerusalem. Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our ail. Depart ye, go ye out from thence. Touch no unclean thing, go ye out of the midst of her. Be ye clean that bear the vessels of Yahweh. We see a glimpse in verse 7 of the joy and rejoicing in the future age. Brother Thomas says that feet without the association of fire are indicative of good. For when, he says, we think of feet, we think of progress, and we think of movement. Thy God reigneth. What a time to which we can all look forward, when the world shall indeed see the salvation of Yah. Brother Andrew based his exhortation last week on the talents mentioned in the gospel records. My grandmother used to say that not all of us are a pint jug, but if we are a pint jug, then God expects us to give the full pint. If we are a half pint, he doesn't expect a full pint, but he does expect the half, which is all that we can give. Indeed, not all of us are five talent men, but if we are, then we must give to God the five talents. If at our best we are only one talent, then God still expects the one talent from us. The woman of Samaria, who gave the penny, gave all that she had. Let us never forget, brethren and sisters, that the law was predicated upon 10 key commandments, the first of which is, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might and mind. A swimmer left England earlier in the week to cross the English Channel. He trained for 9 months without a break to ensure that he was prepared and to ensure that he got to the other side without harm and to do something which meant so much to him as an individual. After all his efforts and surprisingly coming in to Calais in the list of the top 50th fastest people to make the crossing, that's all he had was a pat on the back and an applause by those around him. What a lot of effort for an incorruptible crown. But it gives us an insight, does it not, to the effort that Yahweh expects of us in preparation for us to achieve an incorruptible crown. The one thing which struck me in the gathering at North Carolina this year is that at the end of each of the 7 epistles, the set suffix is the same. To him that overcometh. To him that overcometh. Is the vision we have of the future a dim one? Or are the words of Isaiah something of encouragement and of importance to us. The unclean and the uncircumcised are to be put out of Jerusalem in the future age. And for us to be there, so too must we follow the counsel of the Apostle Paul when he says, "Touch not the unclean." The exhortation, brethren and sisters, to me and to everyone present here this morning is to put on our beautiful garments and to be a people ready and prepared that when the Ancient of Days shall come in his glory, we might say, The bridegroom cometh. Go ye out to meet him. Bring forth into joy. Sing together.
Thank you, Brother Steve, for those helpful words, those words of encouragement and rebuke. We will continue this meeting by singing hymn 70. How few receive with cordial faith the tidings which we bring. How few have seen the arm revealed of heaven's anointed King. Hymn 70.